for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. America's unemployment picture is not entirely dark. There have been some bright areas, as in manufacturing and restaurants. Both have seen jobs growth in the past year. But too many Americans remain out of work, and too many have been forced to take jobs that don't pay enough to support a family. We talk about what's happening in the U.S. job market and why. Joining me in the studio, Lawrence Michel of the Economic Policy Institute, Tim Fernholz of National Journal, and James Shirk of the Heritage Foundation. We do invite your calls, comments, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Tim, if I could start with you, Senator McConnell's proposal on how to get around this deficit deal is on the front pages of every newspaper this morning. Talk about what he's proposing and what's likely to happen.
Sure. So Senator McConnell is the Republican leader, and he is offering a plan that would basically allow the president to raise the debt ceiling himself. And it's a pretty cynical political calculation on Senator McConnell's part. Basically, he's saying that he doesn't think it's going to be possible to get a big debt reduction deal in the next week and a half that we have before the Treasury runs out of cash. So rather than go through that messy process and suffer the political consequences, he essentially wants the Democrats and President Obama to shoulder the burden of raising the borrowing ceiling with a series of votes up through 2012. That he thinks is going to give him some political advantage.
James Shirk, a cynical political calculation.
Well, cynical and probably unconstitutional. The president doesn't have the authority to issue debt. Congress is trying to abrogate their responsibility. You could imagine if they passed a plan to say the president will propose a ton of spending cuts and they'll take effect unless we've got a veto-proof majority. That wouldn't pass constitutional muster, and this probably doesn't either. And in any event, it's completely irresponsible. What he's trying to do is avoid taking responsibility and allow your current policies to continue with no change and not take the necessary steps to bring down spending and actually fix the problems that got us here in the first place.
Larry Michel, his conservative base is certainly having real problems with his plan.
Well, the conservative base has problems with anything because they live in another world that says that the deficit somehow got caused by something that President Obama did. We need to understand exactly where this deficit comes from. First and foremost, we have a huge recession. In a huge recession, people aren't working, businesses aren't producing as much, they pay less in taxes. We have a temporarily higher spending for Medicaid, unemployment benefits, food stamps to help those who are in need. Secondly, the other reasons are we've been cutting taxes, and we have had two unfunded wars. We have a prescription drug plan passed by George W. Bush that was unfunded. And the way to really understand this is the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which proposed the deficit package, got the deficit to the debt to GDP ratio down to a certain amount in 2020. And it's called courageous, even though I don't think it is. You could get to the same place if we just didn't have the Bush tax cuts. That really tells you exactly where we got this. So what this is a political ploy. It fits with Senator McConnell, what he said right after the election, which is his first priority is to make sure that President Obama is a one-term president.
James Shirk.
Well, the long-term problem is what you have to take a look at here. If it was only a short-term recession and then things were going to be fine after that, then this wouldn't be a huge debate. We could agree to the short-term borrowing. The problem is long-term. You look at a decade from here, you've still got deficits as far as the eye can see, But the recession's over in the projections. Tax revenues have come back up to where they were before, of about a sixth of the economy. You know, unemployment's come back down to its natural rate. But we're still running these enormous deficits because the federal spending is just skyrocketing. It's really a spending problem. Where the deficits are coming from over the long term is, part of it's the spending Larry mentioned, like the prescription drug benefits and the wars. But it is a spending problem. And we need to take steps to bring the spending down.
All right. And we'll move now on to jobs. I want to know, what about resolving this federal debt issue? Would it in and of itself create the confidence in the private sector to create new jobs? James Shirk.
Well, it's not as though there's a quick fix. There's a lot of reasons unemployment's high. Solving this problem isn't going to fix the fact we had a housing bubble. It's not going to change the trends we're seeing in manufacturing towards automation. There's not any one policy you can pass that a year from now it's going to get us back to 5% unemployment. It would be great, but we just don't have a magic wand. But that said, it would certainly help. What a lot of the Federal Reserve Bank presidents are saying that they're hearing from the businesses they talk to is uncertainty over what's going to happen to their taxes in the future. And just concern, are we going to wind up paying significantly more, is part of what's holding them back from hiring.
And to you, Larry, Michelle, is uncertainty is something people have been talking about for a year now. What accounted for last week's totally bleak numbers?
That's an important question. Before getting there, let me just summarize some of what's being said about the debt limit. We can have a tremendous harm to the economy if the debt limit doesn't go up and government has to scale back its spending, interest rates go up, et cetera, et cetera. Getting the debt limit raised is not going to be anything positive. And I don't believe that getting a deficit reduction deal for the long term has much to do with getting jobs growing right now. Absolutely none. I mean, the only reason to do a big deficit deal, in my view, is if you are going to raise the deficit over the next few years with spending that can actually create jobs to lower unemployment, and then to reassure the market that you're dealing with the long term responsibly, you can do a big deal. But let me turn to the uncertainty. You hear that a lot, but there is no evidence for it. And let me just summarize what essentially is being said. If businesses are uncertain and therefore they're not hiring, are they really saying that there are profitable sales to be made that they are foregoing because there is uncertainty? In fact, if you look at the evidence of what employers are actually doing, that doesn't fit the pattern. Investment in equipment and software has been growing very quickly. It's doing better in this recovery than under George Bush's recovery. Private sector employment is growing faster in this recovery than it did in the last two recoveries. When you look at the survey of the NFIB, small business people, they say their prime problem is a lack of sales. And also, businesses, if they wanted to produce more, they don't have to hire any new people. They just have to add hours of work to their already employed workers who are working far fewer hours than they did before the recession. Doesn't fit the facts.
Tim Fernholz, I know you've been writing about this, following this. What difference could it make if, in fact, the debt limit were lifted?
Well, as Larry says, the real issue with raising the debt limit is avoiding a potential catastrophe. But the real problem for jobs is a fiscal consolidation deal that would lower the deficit is likely going to hurt growth. When you have spending cuts, especially in the near term, and that takes demand out of the economy, that's going to, economists from major banks, from universities say, reduce growth and reduce jobs. And if taxes are increased, which the Democrats want to do, you're going to see that negative effect as well. When you look at fiscal consolidation, you get lower growth. And that's the real bind lawmakers are in right now. They want to deal with the deficit and the debt and reduce that overhang. At the same time, they want to get out of this recession. And the two are sort of contradictory.
James Shirk.
Well, it's interesting. There's been a lot of countries who've had similar fiscal situations like us where they've had to close their budget deficits. And researchers from Harvard have taken a look at this, Alberto Alesina. And what he's found is when you have those sort of fiscal consolidations that are all or almost entirely all spending cuts, then actually you've got better job growth, better employment growth, the economy does better. When it's mostly or a significant portion of it is in higher taxes, the economy doesn't do as well. And it's not actually that hard to see why. I mean, the same survey that Larry was just mentioning, it's a monthly survey of small business owners. A quarter of them are saying that poor sales are their top problem. But the next two problems are 20% are saying taxes and 15% are saying government regulations and,
yeah,
and red tape.
I want to stop you right there because before we get to regulations, I'd like to better understand how getting rid of tax breaks for oil companies could or would affect Americans. Tim Fernholz.
Sure. I just want to make one point about the study that James just cited. I believe Mr. Alessino only found a few cases where fiscal consolidation actually resulted in growth. The International Monetary Fund sort of questioned that study. And when you look at near-term examples like the United Kingdom and Ireland, where they have cut their budgets recently, their growth rates have gone down quite a bit. And debt rating agencies are saying, look, we're going to have to downgrade your debt if we don't see more expansion. On this question of tax loopholes like the oil company, one that the Democrats have been pushing, it's not clear that that would increase jobs. That's not really going to have an effect like that. What it would do, would it increase government revenue? And if you believe, like a lot of policymakers do, that you don't want unfair advantages in the tax code, you could see over time more economic growth come from having, you know, no distortions like those loopholes. But in the near term, the Democrats are talking about raising revenue.
Tim Fernholz, he's correspondent for National Journal Magazine. Also here in the studio, Larry Mischel of the Economic Policy Institute and James Shurka of the Heritage Foundation. We'll take a short break. I see the lines are filled. We'll talk with our guests a little further and then take your calls. Stay with us. And welcome back. Three guests are here in the studio with me as we talk about job growth, what's happening, what hasn't been happening, and what could happen with or without government help. Larry Mischel is president of the Economic Policy Institute. Tim Fernholz is correspondent for National Journal Magazine. James Shurk is senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation. We've talked about some of the bright spots, what has happened in the economy with some job growth, but how are taxes, high taxes, holding back what's happening in job growth? Larry Mischel.
Well, it's hard to believe that high taxes are holding back job growth because our taxes as a share of the economy are the lowest in 50, 60 years. So it can't possibly be taxes. What we do know is that growth has been slow. And why is growth slow? Because we have the aftermath of a financial crisis, the housing bubble, the stock market bubble, where consumers have lost wealth, they've cut back on spending, they're trying to pay down their debts. We have a loss of demand. We have the total demand in the economy has only grown 3.5% over the last 3.5 years. You would expect it to grow by something like 10%. So we have two few people trying to buy things. And the solution to that is, in fact, not to cut government spending or raise taxes in the near term. The challenge is actually to increase the demand for goods and services. And you can do that a lot of different ways. The president is talking about extending the payroll tax holiday on the employee side only. He's talking about renewing the unemployment benefits for next year. Those benefits alone support spending in the economy that creates 700,000 jobs.
James Shirk.
Look, I've just got to disagree. We've been trying to increase demand both through the stimulus bill, but also the Federal Reserve with monetary policy, and it really hasn't had an effect. I think you need to take a look at why unemployment is still so high. It's interesting. The layoff rate has fallen. So layoffs went up during the recession, but now if you have a job, you're less likely to lose it than you were before the recession began. But the hiring rate, which plunged by about 20% when the recession started, has not recovered. Employers are only creating about as many new jobs now as they were when the recession began. What you want to do is create a climate that encourages business to hire. If you're a small business owner in the top tax bracket, then you're paying basically 40, 45 cents, depending on what state you're in, of every additional dollar you make is getting taken out of your money to go to the government.
All right. Here's an email from Jack in Dickerson, Maryland. I'll be interested in your reactions. He says, I'm a small business owner, and tax management is an integral part of managing my business. I do not feel tax increases will adversely affect economic growth and job creation. Rather, they could enhance them. When I am looking at my bottom line, I have two choices. Number one, pay taxes, keep the profit, or two, invest in equipment, much of which can be expensed to reduce taxes. When taxes are high, there is greater incentive to invest, to avoid paying taxes. This increased investment will cause increased hiring down the supply chain. Tim Fernholz.
Well, I think he makes a good point, and it also gets at one of the tensions in tax reform. Both parties have been talking about the need to make the United States a more competitive climate for business investment, and one of the ways they want to do that is lower the corporate tax rate, by closing tax loopholes. Now, the problem there is the same benefits this gentleman is talking about from investing in new equipment, those benefits would be taken away to lower the overall top rates. So is that better or worse for the economy? I think a lot of economists would say those lower rates would allow this gentleman to make business decisions based not on the tax code, but on, you know, what he thinks is the best choice. But at the same time, you do lose some of those incentives.
Go ahead, James.
Well, ultimately, a business is only going to invest in a new equipment or new machinery if they think they're going to make more money off of it later in the future. So ultimately, let's say he buys a new machine and he's becoming much more profitable. Well, then he has to pay taxes on those profits. I mean, you've got 20% of small business owners say that taxes are their single greatest problem. You know, greater than poor sales, greater than anything else. One in five small business owners are saying that. And I think that's something you have to, you know, take pretty seriously if that's
Larry,
what they're saying.
Michelle.
I think it's very important that we, when talking about jobs, I think that the media and economists talk past the American people. So I just want to get something pretty clear. Right now, the unemployment rate at the end of 2012 was projected to be 8% or more. Now, when you talk about jobs, what I want to ask people is, what you're talking about, is that going to change that projection so that it's not 8%, but it's 7% or 6%? The kind of thing that the Heritage Foundation is talking about, the Republicans, whatever it might be, if it actually has that effect, might affect job growth somewhat over the longer term. It will not move the dial on whether we have 8% unemployment at the end of 2012. Now, getting to the taxes, there's also a very weird sort of otherworldliness to the tax discussion, and that is the following. The conservatives and Republicans say that if you raise taxes, that hurts the recovery, but if you cut spending, it actually helps the recovery. So they're basically saying that if you take a dollar out of a rich person's pocket, it actually hurts the recovery. But if I put a dollar of unemployment benefits into a working class person's pocket, it doesn't help the recovery. Now, that can't possibly be true.
James Shirk.
So who are these rich we keep hearing about? Instead of saying rich, you could say investors and entrepreneurs. And yes, if you raise taxes on investors and entrepreneurs, that's a less favorable business climate for them. You raise taxes on investors and entrepreneurs, you're less likely to get them taking the risk of starting up a new business. Remember, the majority of new businesses fail. You know, most people who put in all that time and effort and money into a new venture don't see anything back from it. If you want them to take that risk, it's not a terribly great idea to have the government promising
but you
to
know,
take it.
It's fascinating to me that during the Bush era, and then following the Bush era, we were told that there would be jobs if we extended the Bush era tax breaks. What happened, Tim Fernholz?
Well, I think what you saw happen was that we were in a recession and there was a resistance to raising taxes during a recession. And I think you're talking about at the end of last year when the Bush tax cuts were set to expire, President and Congress made a deal to extend them through 2012. That, economists say, is a pretty good idea in terms of keeping growth moving forward, but it is also fiscally unsustainable. If you look at the projections of the Congressional Budget Office, you know, the revenue problem is as real as the spending problem. You really have two issues. You have healthcare spending, which is going up very quickly, faster than anything else, and you have revenue, which is at historically low levels. And, you know, in terms of talking about job creation, what James said is true. It's important to look at how tax incentives are affecting small businesses, but no one's talking about raising taxes on small businesses right now. The Democrats are talking about closing loopholes that affect a lot of big profitable companies, oil companies, things like that, as part of the debt deal. And then we're looking ahead to the Bush tax cut debate that will be in 2012.
All right. I want to get to something you raised earlier, James, and that is regulation. What evidence is there that regulations are slowing job creation?
Well, one, it's what businesses are saying themselves. And that's not just me saying that. The Federal Reserve presidents are saying they're hearing the same thing. To quote Dennis Lockhart, he's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta. And he says, and I'm quoting him, "We frequently heard strong comments to the effect of, my company won't hire a single additional worker until we know what health insurance costs are going to be. More generally, our contacts cite a litany of uncertainties as a reason for a wait-and-see posture towards expansion. And spending and hiring. These include the longer-term fiscal plan at the federal level, the extension of the Bush tax cuts, and the effect of various regulatory proposals."
Last portion of his statement, and of course, we're going to hear from Ben Bernanke today. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, what James is offering is what people are saying. We should look at what people are saying and what they are doing. In terms of what they're saying, the same survey that James is citing about people being worried about regulation and taxes, it goes back to 1986. If you look at the last 6 years of the Reagan-Bush era, their concerns were as high then as they are now. And some of that
about
regulation or taxes, okay? Even higher than they are now. If you look what businesses are doing, do we really believe that business owner who could sell something and make a profit won't increase the hours of work from people that are part-time to full-time to produce, to make a profit, would not hire a temporary worker or even hire a worker on some kind of temporary basis, not through an agency? That doesn't make sense.
What does that have to do with regulation?
Well, the reason is that if they're saying they won't hire someone because they're afraid of that the future,
yeah,
you don't have to make
it. Tell me about regulation and how you think regulation plays into
it. I think it doesn't play into it whatsoever.
All right.
This is a made-up, ginned-up political crisis by the Chamber of Commerce, which has been generating millions of dollars in research and advocacy, trying to get down regulation. It has absolutely no economic basis behind it whatsoever.
Tim Fernholz.
So I think it's a mistake to think about regulation as just some overarching big category. You know, regulations are just government rules about anything. So there are specific regulations like what the Environmental Protection Agency might put forward about emissions, where you might have an energy company that is going to be less profitable because they have to obey these. But you do get a benefit. You have healthier air. Your kids don't have asthma. Acid rain is going away, whatever. on the question of the health care law in particular, that's more complex because there are going to be rules. There is uncertainty about what businesses will have to pay. But as Larry says, it's not clear that these regulations are affecting profitability so much that they would affect investment decisions. And there's also a point on this uncertainty debate, which is that Washington changes regulations all the time. And there's rarely a period where you can't look down the road 2 or 3 years and say, look, there's going to be a major tax change, a major regulatory change, something like that. So this is an environment that folks in business are prepared to deal with. They will, of course, continue to advocate for laxer regulations, lower regulations, because that's more profitable for them. But what the administration is trying to do is balance the public interest against the private. There's a lot of calculations that go into business investment and hiring more people, and it's not clear that new regulations imposed in the last year, keep in mind that the healthcare law rules, the financial law rules are still being written. They're not even implemented yet. So it's not clear that that affected job creation in the last 2 years or the last 10.
James.
Well, the question you have if you're a business is, do you take a risk and invest? It's not so much, you know, do I shut my doors today? I mean, you, for some companies, you raise their costs with these and they'll shut the doors today. But the question is, do I open up a new branch? Do I expand? And that's going to be based on what you think is going to happen to you in the future. And I think especially Obamacare, there was a poll out of business owners yesterday that was showing that a third of business respondents said that the new healthcare law was either the greatest or the second greatest problem they faced and a barrier to new hiring. I mean, that's a really big deal. They don't know what their healthcare costs are going to be, but they know they're going up.
Are we still calling this Obamacare, or is it the healthcare plan?
Well, that's just a political answer he's giving.
No. I really want to know.
I was going to weigh out on something. I would say you can call it Obamacare if you want. I mean, people are going to call it what they want. He's associated with it. That's fine. But just on this point of healthcare costs, on this healthcare plan, if nothing was done, you would see businesses have huge healthcare costs. One of the big reasons they did healthcare reform was to make it cheaper and easier for businesses.
Tim Fernholz, correspondent for National Journal Magazine, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850, first to Wakefield, Rhode Island, and to Tony, if we can get these phones open. Tony in Wakefield, Rhode Island. I'm afraid it's just not working right now. So go ahead, James.
This is Larry.
Go ahead, Larry.
I just want to what seems so otherworldly to me, this discussion of regulation in the abstract, is that we are in the largest worldwide, you know, depression, a great recession, it's the greatest, highest unemployment in 70, 80 years. And it's because of a financial crisis caused, in my view, from regulators who didn't do their job and regulations that weren't effective. And here we have people saying somehow the problem is regulation. And they're the same people that, in my view, actually are responsible for this great recession, which is also the same reason we have the large deficit. So for people to turn around and say regulation is the problem, that their ideology and policies that dominated 30 years of politics in Democratic and Republican administrations just seems otherworldly to me. I should also say we've looked at actual regulations, including the largest regulation that EPA is doing, which is called the Toxics Rule, which will keep mercury out of the lungs of the people of America as power plants spew their waste. And that doesn't lose jobs whatsoever. There's going to be so much investment in pollution control equipment that any higher costs from energy are going to be totally offset by new jobs created in protecting the people.
James.
Look, there's no regulations we could have passed that would have prevented the asset bubble. I mean, Dodd-Frank, none of the proposals that were out there would have stopped the investment in the subprime mortgages. People in the economy make bad mistakes. That's why we got the tech bubble. People thought that the tech stocks were worth more than they were. People thought that the subprime mortgages were more stable than they were because you had this housing bubble. I mean, that's not something – there's not a government regulation wand that you can wave that's going to solve these problems or make them go away. What you can do is choose whether or not you're going to unnecessarily raise business costs. And you've got things like the EPA right now proposing these regulations on carbon dioxide. We know that's going to make energy much more expensive if you're going to essentially try and implement these controls through regulations.
I want to ask you about that, James, because I have been sitting at this microphone long enough to remember the huge protests we got from the automobile industry, first about seat belts and then about airbags, and crying about the fact that such costs would be inflated and passed on to consumers, and it would make consumers stop buying cars and automobile manufacturers stop making cars. None of that happened. And I just find myself wondering why we keep putting safety things into that kind of light.
Well, certainly the cost of the safety regulations do get passed on to consumers. It's a question of, is this, you know, worth the cost? And for something like seatbelts, I think all of us, you know, would say yes. Of course, that's worth the cost.
You would have 30 years ago. And we've got to take a short break here. When we come back, I hope we can open the phones. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, and by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Hoarding. What causes some people to collect so much stuff it threatens to engulf them? Why pathological hoarders find it so hard to let anything go? The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. And welcome back. I have an email here from Tony, who says, I hear that there are upwards of 2 million jobs going unfilled in our economy. Number one, is this true? Number two, what are these jobs? Are they professional, doctors, engineers, scientists, etc., skilled blue-collar? Construction needs specialized training, or labor, farm workers, etc. Tim?
Well, I think I can't speak to that specific number that you mentioned. I think it's clear that there are job openings going unfilled, and most of those would be jobs that would require more education, certain credentials. There certainly is a component of our unemployment problem that is structural. But you still see more job seekers looking for jobs than you have job openings. So that's not the entire story.
Larry?
Absolutely true. I mean, the big picture is that there are 4.7 unemployed for every job opening. And that is quite higher than the worst point in the last recession, where it reached 2.8. So there's many more people. There's a cruel game of musical chairs of people looking for work. The chairs are a job opening. And we have far fewer job openings in this recovery than in the last one. We
All
need
right.
to create more openings.
And one more email, then we'll go to the phones. It's from Nancy, who says, I want a good education for my children, good roads to drive on, maintained parks, etc. Taxes pay for these things. I don't understand how people don't want to pay taxes but expect services. Fortunately, in this economy, my family is among those who would have our taxes raised. That's okay. It's only fair. James.
Well, anyone who wants to send a check to the Treasury is very welcome to do so.
I don't think that's the issue.
But there's benefits provided by government spending, and there's cost. And I think what people are saying is, yes, you've got some essential programs, but the government's grown too big, the spending is growing too large, and the kind of burden it's putting on investment, on entrepreneurs, on job creation. I mean, if you're paying, as a business owner, 40, 45 cents at every additional dollar you make, I mean, that's quite a lot the government's taking out of your income.
I want to follow up on that, because when we get into this talk about taxes and job growth, the conversation comes almost exclusively down to small business. What about corporations? To what extent are they holding back? And why? What's the difference between what corporations are doing and small businesses, Larry?
Well, the large corporate political agenda is always put forward in with the face of small business, and I think that's all you're hearing, pure and simple, full stop. Now, in terms of taxes, if you look at polls, you find nearly a majority of Republicans would want to see higher taxes, a clear majority of independents, and a majority of Democrats. It's really funny that we had the Bush tax cuts, which were not a demand to the American people. When those were passed, that was not in response to the public actually saying we wanted that. Right now, what the public is saying is they would like to see a deficit reduction. They want to see it balanced. They'd like some combination of higher revenues and smaller spending. The whole idea that any change in taxes is somehow super powered and is going to stop the economy in its track is totally a myth.
All right. Let's open the phones and go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Kent. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a wonderful show. You're hitting all the nails on the head as a 20-year business owner, and I know lots and lots of mid-size and large business owners. You know, the taxes is something they complain about mostly, and this is my opinion, because of greed. They make more than enough money to live on just in general. If they can make more money by hiring somebody, they're going to make that money whether they pay 50% in tax or 10% in tax. The tax is on your net profit. It's not a business expense per se. And the regulations, you know, I think it was James, I'm not sure. He's totally wrong, and no government regulation would have.
All right. I'm afraid we're losing you, Kent. Do you want to comment, James?
Look, the problem with taxes is you're taking a risk as a business. When you invest in starting up a new company or opening up an expansion, you don't know if it's going to succeed. It could be something like, you know, the new Coke, which of course was a disaster, or it could be something like Google, which was a tremendous success. And so the question is it worth risking the money and the capital you have now in exchange for the reward you get after taxes? You raise the taxes, and there's less reward from a success, but you still bear all the cost of a failure.
Larry.
Right now, the profits in corporations is 25% higher than it was before the recession. We have higher profitability now than we had, you know, in basically in this decade, more so than in, you know, 30 years ago. The problem business is facing is not high enough profits or profit expectations. The problem is they don't have customers.
Here's an email from Daniel, who says, is there actually any evidence that tax cuts and deregulation create jobs in recessions or otherwise? I would think more jobs would be created when high demand makes a new job necessary, not when a business owner says, now that I don't have to pay as much or deal with as many safety standards, I guess I'll hire somebody. James.
Well, there actually have been studies that show that when you reduce the tax burden, then entrepreneurs are more likely to start up a new business, and they're more likely, and they hire more workers when they do. Entrepreneurs, they react to the costs that are available or that they're imposed on them. If you're going to take more of their money if they're successful, then they're less likely to take that risk.
Tim.
I just want to note for context for all the listeners that the tax environment right now is more attractive than it maybe has ever been in the United States. We're still under the Bush tax cuts, which were lower than under the Clinton years, certainly lower than the Reagan years in the 70s and 60s. We also have a passel of business investment tax incentives as part of the stimulus package and that tax deal that still exists. So if you're an entrepreneur right now, you have the lowest tax situation maybe in American history. Now, you're going to point out, I think, the Medicare tax increase is coming up. That's still relatively small, but taxes were, for the most expensive small businesses, 5% higher in the 90s.
All right, to Morristown, New Jersey. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I have to say that the anti-tax comments I've heard, and I've owned and run a small business for 35 years, the anti-tax comments come from somebody who has never owned and operated a small business. It's preposterous. Give me a choice of making 55 cents on a dollar that I wouldn't have otherwise made, I'll take that deal any day of the week, and so will any other small businessman. The other part of my comment is that we as Americans seem to have totally disconnected from economic reality. When you have an unemployed steelworker in Ohio voting for Republicans because he hates gay marriage, this is a man who's lost sight of his own self-interest.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. What about that, James?
Well, again, they don't know that they're going to make the money. You take a risk and you invest in it. If it succeeds, you get to keep whatever's left after taxes. If it fails, you lose everything.
Well, but, you know, with so much of this debate focused not on whether you start up, but on small business as it exists, it seems rather odd to focus so intentionally on small business, Larry.
Well, we should also look at a little bit of history here. We had a time in the Clinton first budget where he raised taxes, and Republicans said this was going to crater the economy. It didn't. We actually had the best job growth over the last 30 years in that period that ensued. Then you can look at the period when Bush cut taxes, cut capital gains taxes, taxes on dividends, cut taxes on the high-end earner. And we had the worst recovery of the post-war period. Wages didn't grow one penny in real terms, in inflation-adjusted terms. It was the worst period of job growth, but it was a very good period for profits. So our experience is not that cutting taxes is a magic elixir. It absolutely isn't.
All right, to Jim in Tyson's Corner, Virginia. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thank you. I think a big part of the confusion here is, you know, we've got a great panel, but kindly, I don't think any of you have ever run a business. I have two small businesses, and I provide consulting services to small businesses. You also have to figure out what's a small business. There's a huge difference between somebody who has 5 employees in a small business and somebody who has 100 employees in a small business. Those small businesses that have over 50 or 75 employees, where all of these regulations start to kick in, regulations and taxes make a huge, huge impact on them. You know, I talk to our business people, we're fine with probably, you know, taxes over $500,000, increasing the rates on that, but also making the corporate tax code sane so that drop that rate down to 20%, get away with all the deductions. But to hear Obama up there talking about corporate jets and oil company special advisors, that provides no confidence to people who really understand what's going on, because it shows that the guy just has no clue. You know, it takes 500 years of the corporate tax break to solve this issue. And to say that increasing costs on a business that has 100 employees, which is still considered a small business, and I think that's what a lot of people get confused about is, you know, a dry cleaner, yeah, it's a small business, but so is a small manufacturing plant that has 50 or 75.
All right, Larry.
I think it's interesting that we've now been 50 minutes into this discussion and we really haven't talked much about what I think actually creates jobs. And the discussion is hijacked by the constant business agenda over the last 30 years about deregulation and lower taxes. You know, which I think is totally not based on evidence.
So what do you think creates jobs?
I'll be glad. What a great question, Diane.
Good.
What a great question. Well, I think we have to do things that are going to actually create a lot of jobs and lower the unemployment rate over the next 18 months. We can do this by renewing the unemployment benefits, which gives money to people that are going to spend it. It's the most effective thing, according to the Congressional Budget
Office.
But
that's not going to create jobs.
It will create jobs. Because when you give money to people who are unemployed and they spend it, they go out into their drugstore, they go out into their supermarket, they pay their mortgage, they go out and buy things at the department store.
All right.
That makes businesses give people something, you know, to produce for, to sell. They then hire people. Then they order supplies.
Okay, so increasing or extending the unemployment rate.
And
what
same
else?
With the payroll tax holiday. We can do infrastructure. We can modernize our schools. We can do things. Right now, one of the biggest problems in America is that the state and local governments are cutting back. We're losing jobs in the public sector. For every job lost in the public sector, there's another job lost in the private sector. Now, preventing that would really help us move forward.
Tim?
Well, Larry is talking about essentially creating a virtuous cycle that you want to see in the economy where more folks are spending, more people are getting hired. And that's what the president tried to do in the stimulus plan, for instance, which economists think had some effect but largely wasn't large enough. And for policymakers right now, the issue is that, one, Congress, where House Republicans are really setting the agenda, is not concerned about jobs. The issue is the debt and the deficit. Policymakers aren't talking about this. And the administration has basically given up convincing Congress to do the kinds of proposals that Larry suggests.
Tim Fernaholz of National Journal Magazine, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Leesburg, Virginia. Hi there, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Go right in.
Oh, hi. Sorry. First of all, excellent show as always.
Thank you.
Especially on this topic. I wanted to ask about your guess about the role of the stimulus, because it seems to me that the evidence is so strong that the stimulus had a huge positive impact in blunting the rate of unemployment back in 2009, and that there's a very good argument that could be made that right now we're seeing pretty much the end of the stimulus in various areas, the end of subsidies to governments, state governments, so that they're laying people off, that the new layoffs are largely caused by the end of stimulus, the end of the stimulus for housing buying and so on, and that the argument for more stimulus to deal with the jobs seems to be really, really strong. And then long term, isn't it the case that if the longer we have a recession, the more the deficit's going to grow for that reason?
All right, Tim Fernaholz.
I think the caller makes a great point, which is that the stimulus did, in fact, improve the economy, improve economic growth, and a lot of the sluggishness we're starting to see in the economy now is because it's running out. And people have pointed out that the U.S.'s borrowing costs right now for us to get more money to do that, to run a deficit, are historically low. People still have a lot of confidence, despite what's going on with the debt ceiling in U.S. Treasury bonds. But, you know, again, you have this issue where the long-term debt issue, long-term healthcare spending, is really dominating in the minds of Congress, particularly in House Republicans. And the House Republicans feel like they have a mandate to talk about smaller government and cutting spending.
James.
Look, the stimulus has been a failure by the administration's own measures. They predicted if we passed the stimulus that we'd have 6.5% unemployment right now. Without any stimulus, we'd be at 8% unemployment. Well, we passed it and we're at 9% unemployment. And the reason is, if you're a business owner, let's say the government's spending you new money on, say, your solar panels.
Well, if you're someone who produces these solar panels, you know the stimulus runs out in 2 years. Why in the world would you build an additional plant? You might work your workers in overtime, hire a few more guys at the margins, but you're not going to invest an entire new plant when you know the entire thing's going to run out in 2 years. It doesn't have any permanent effect on increasing hiring.
Tim.
Well, just to note, you know, there are plenty of empirical examples that counteract that. Alcoa, as part of the stimulus, the big aluminum company, made huge investments in new plants because, you know, they wanted to take advantage of the opportunity to make those investments cheaper, and then when the economy recovered, to have that advantage and be able to sell more. So you did see some of those stories. You know, it's not cut and dried, and frankly, the stimulus package was not well designed in terms of instituting those kinds of permanent changes. But the evidence is that we saw that happen. Now, the fact is it underperformed what the administration forecast. They were wrong about that, but that doesn't change its effects.
One final email from Dennis in Dayton, Ohio. I had 34 employees in 2001 at the Clinton tax rates and was profitable. I have 14 employees now at Bush tax rates and am barely able to have any profits to pay taxes on. Taxes as the number one problem for small business is a bunch of hooey. Let me make more profit and I will gladly pay more taxes. Just something from Dennis in Dayton, Ohio. Want to thank you all, Larry Michel, Tim Fernholz, James Shirk, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.